man to bet your life on what I dare. How bold are you?" The young man licked his lips, but he did not meet Glockter's gaze for long. "I thought not. He reminds me of my friend Captain Luthar, all flash and arrogance, but with no kind of character to hang it on. Prick him with a pin, and he sags like a punctured wineskin. 6 months' food, 6 months for everyone, and see that it's done promptly. Grocery boy?" "Of course," growled Worms, still staring grimly at the floor. "Then we can get started on the water. The wells, the cisterns, the pumps. People will need something to wash all that hard work down with, eh? You will report to me every morning." Worms' fists clenched and unclenched by his sides, his jaw muscles worked with fury. "Of course," he managed to splutter. "Of course. You may go." Glockter watched him stalk away. "And I have talked to 2 out of 4. 2 of 4, and I have made 2 enemies. I will need allies if I am to succeed here. Without allies, I will not last, regardless of what documents I hold. Without allies, I will not keep the Gurkish out if they decide to try and come in. Worse yet, I still know nothing of Davoust. A superior of the Inquisition disappeared into thin air. Let us hope the Archlector will be patient." "Hope? Archlector? Patience?" Glockter frowned. "Never have 3 ideas belonged together less." Chapter 6. The Thing About Trust. The wheel on the cart turned slowly round and squeaked. It turned round again and squeaked. Pharaoh scowled at it. "Damn wheel, damn cart." She shifted her scorn from the cart to its driver. "Damn apprentice." She didn't trust him a finger's breadth. His eyes flickered over to her, lingered an insulting moment, then darted off. As if he knew something about Pharaoh that she did not know herself. That made her angry. She looked away from him to the first of the horses and its rider. Damn Union boy with his stiff back, sitting in his saddle like a king sits on his throne, as though being born with a good-shaped face was an achievement to be endlessly proud of. He was pretty and neat and dainty as a princess. Pharaoh smiled grimly to herself. The princess of the Union, that's what he was. She hated fine-looking people, even more than ugly ones. Beauty was never to be trusted. You would have had to look far and wide to find anyone less beautiful than the big 9-fingered bastard. He sat in his saddle, slumped over like some great sack of rice. Slow-moving, scratching, sniffing, chewing like a big cow. Trying to look like he had no killing in him, no mad fury, no devil. She knew better. He nodded to her, and she scowled back. He was a devil wearing a cow's skin, and she was not fooled. Better than that damn navigator, though. Always talking, always smiling, always laughing. Pharaoh hated talk, and smiles, and laughter, each one more than the last. Stupid little man with his stupid tales. Underneath all his lies, he was plotting, watching. She could feel it. That left the first of the Magi, and she trusted him least of all. She saw his eyes sliding to the cart, looking at the sack he'd put the box in. Square, grey, dull, heavy box. He thought no one had seen, but she had. Full of secrets is what he was. Bald bastard, with his thick neck and his wooden pole, acting as if he had done nothing but good in his life, as if he would not know where to begin at making a man explode. "Damn fucking pinks," she whispered to herself. She leaned over and spat onto the track, glowered at their 5 backs as they rode ahead of her. Why had she let Yulwe talk her into this madness? A voyage way off into the cold west where she had no business. She should have been back in the south, fighting the Gurkish, making them pay what they owed her. Cursing the name of Yulwe silently to herself, she followed the others up to the bridge. It looked ancient. Pitted stones splattered with stains of lichen, the surface of it rutted deep where a cart's wheels would roll. Thousands of years of carts rolling back and forward. The stream gurgled under its single arch, bitter cold water flowing fast. A low hut stood beside the bridge, settled and slumped into the landscape over long years. Some wisps of smoke were snatched from its chimney and out across the land in the cutting wind. One soldier stood outside alone. Drew the short straw, maybe. He'd pressed himself against the wall, swathed in a heavy cloak, horsehair on his helmet whipping back and forth in the gusts, his spear ignored beside him. Baez reined his horse in before the bridge and nodded across.
"We're going up onto the plain, out towards Darmium."
"Can't advise it. Dangerous up there."
Baez smiled.
"Dangers mean profits."
"Profits won't stop an arrow, friend."
The soldier looked them up and down, one by one, and sniffed.
"Varied crowd, aren't you?"
"I take good fighters wherever I can find them."
"Course."
He looked over at Pharaoh, and she scowled back.
"Very tough, I'm sure, but the fact is the plains are deadly, and more than ever now. Some traders are still going up there, but they're not coming back. That madman Cabrian has raiders out there, I reckon, keen for plunder. Scario and Galtus, too, they're a little better. We keep some shred of lore on this side of the stream, but once you're up there, you're on your own. There'll be no help for you if you're caught out on the plain."
He sniffed again. "No help at all." Baez nodded grimly. "We ask for none." He spurred his horse, and it began to trot over the bridge onto the track on the other side. The others followed behind, Longfoot first, then Luthar, then Ninefingers. Quai shook the reins, and the cart clattered across. Pharaoh brought up the rear.
"No help at all,"
the soldier called after her, before he wedged himself back against the rough wall of his hut. The Great Plain. It should have been good land for riding, reassuring land. Pharaoh could have seen an enemy coming from miles away. But she saw no one, only the vast carpet of tall grass, waving and thrashing in the wind, stretching away in every direction to the far, far horizon. Only the track broke the monotony, a line of shorter, drier grass popped with patches of bare black earth cutting across the plain straight as an arrow flies. Pharaoh did not like it, this vast sameness. She frowned as they rode, peering left and right. In the Badlands of Cantor, the barren earth was full of features. Broken boulders, withered valleys, dried-up trees casting their cloying shadows, distant creases in the earth full of shade, bright ridges doused in light. In the Badlands of Cantor, the sky above would be empty, still. A bright bowl holding nothing but the blinding sun in the day, the bright stars at night. Here, all was strangely reversed. The earth was featureless, but the sky was full of movement, full of chaos. Towering clouds loomed over the plain, dark and light swirling together into colossal spirals, sweeping over the grassland with the raking wind, shifting, turning, ripping apart and flooding back together, casting monstrous flowing shadows onto the cowering earth, threatening to crush the six tiny riders and their tiny cart with a deluge to sink the world. All hanging over Pharaoh's hunched-up shoulders, the wrath of God made real. This was a strange land, one in which she had no place. She needed reasons to be here, and good ones.
"You, Baez!"
she shouted, drawing up level with him.
"Where are we going?"
he grunted, frowning out across the waving grass from nothing to nothing.
"We are going westwards, across the plain, over the great river Eos, as far as the Broken Mountains. Then?"
She saw the faint lines around his eyes, across the bridge of his nose, grow deeper, watched his lips press together. Annoyance. He did not like her questions.
"Then we go further."
"How long will it take?"
"All of winter and into spring," he snapped, "and then we must come back."
He He dug his heels into his horse's flanks and trotted away from her, up the track towards the front of the group. Pharaoh was not so easily put off, not by this shifty old pink. She dug in her own heels and drew up level with him.
"What is the first law?"
Baez looked sharply over at her.
"What do you know about it?"
"Not enough. I heard you and Yulwe talking through the door."
"Eavesdropping, eh?"
"You have loud voices and I have good ears."
Pharaoh shrugged.
"I'm not sticking a bucket on my head just to keep your secrets. What is the first law?"
The lines round Baez's forehead grew deeper, the corners of his mouth turned down. Anger. "A stricture that Eos placed on his sons, the first rule made after the chaos of ancient days. It is forbidden to touch the other side direct, forbidden to communicate with the world below, forbidden to summon demons, forbidden to open gates to hell. Such is the first law, the guiding principle of all magic."
"Ah," snorted Pharaoh. It meant nothing to her.
"Who is Kalul?"
Baez's thick brows drew in together, his frown deepened, his eyes narrowed.
"Is there no end to your questions, woman?"
Her questions galled him. That was good. That meant they were the right questions.
"You'll know if I stop asking them. Who is Kalul?"
"Kalul was one of the Order of Magi," growled Baez. "One of my order. The second of Juven's 12 apprentices. He was always jealous of my place, always thirsty for power. He broke the second law to get it. He ate the flesh of men, and persuaded others to do the same. He made of himself a false prophet, tricked the Gurkish into serving him. That is Kalul, your enemy and mine."
"What is the seed?"
The Magus's face gave a sudden twitch, fury and perhaps the slightest trace of fear. Then his face softened.
"What is it?"
He smiled at her, and his smile worried her more than all his anger could have. He leaned towards her, close enough that no one else could hear.
"It is the instrument of your vengeance, of our vengeance. But it is dangerous. Even to speak of it is dangerous. There are those who are always listening. It would be wise for you to shut the door on your questions before the answers to them burn us all."
He spurred his horse once again, trotting out ahead of the party on his own. Pharaoh stayed behind. She had learned enough for now. Learned enough to trust this first of the Magi less than ever. A hollow in the ground, no more than 4 strides across. A sink in the soil, ringed by a low wall of damp, dark earth, full of tangled grass roots. That was the best place they had found to camp for the night, and they had been lucky to find it. It was as big a feature in the landscape as Pharaoh had seen all day. The fire that Longfoot had made was burning well now, flames licking bright and hungry at the wood, rustling and flickering out sideways as a gust of wind swept down into the hollow. The 5 pinks sat clustered around it, hunched and huddled for warmth, light from it bright on their pinched-up faces. Longfoot was the only one speaking. His talk was all of his own great achievements, how he had been to this place or that, how he knew this thing or that, how he had a remarkable talent for this or for that. Pharaoh was sick of it already, and had told him so twice. The first time she thought she had been clear. The second time she had made sure of it. He would not be talking to her of his idiot travels again. But the others still suffered in silence. There was space for her down by the fire, but she did not want it. She preferred to sit above them, cross-legged in the grass on the lip of the hollow. It was cold up here in the wind, and she pulled the blanket tighter round her shivering shoulders. A strange and frightening thing, cold. She hated it. But she preferred cold to company. And so she sat apart, sullen and silent, and watched the light drain out of the brooding sky, watched the darkness creep into the land. There was just the faintest glow of the sun now on the distant horizon, a last feeble brightness round the edges of the looming clouds. The big pink stood up and looked at her.
"Getting dark," he said.
"Huh.
Guess that's what happens when the sun goes down, eh?
Huh?
He scratched at the side of his thick neck.
We need to set watches. Could be dangerous out here at night. We'll take it in shifts. I'll go first, then Luthar.
I'll watch, she grunted.
Don't worry. You can sleep. I'll wake you later.
I do not sleep.
He stared at her.
What? Never?
Not often.
Maybe that explains her mood,
murmured Longfoot. Meant to be under his breath, no doubt, but Pharaoh heard him.
My mood is my business, fool.
The navigator said nothing as he wrapped himself in his blanket and stretched out beside the fire.
You want to go first? Said Nine Fingers. Then do it, but wake me a couple of hours in. We each should take our turn.
Slowly, quietly, wincing with the need not to make noise, Pharaoh stole from the cart. Dry meat, dry bread, water flask. Enough to keep her going for days. She shoved it into a canvas bag. One of the horses snorted and shied as she slipped past, and she scowled at it. She could ride. She could ride well, but she wanted nothing to do with horses. Damn fool, big beasts. Smelled bad. They might move quick, but they needed too much food and water. You could see and hear them from miles away. They left great big tracks to follow. Riding a horse made you weak. Rely on a horse, and when you need to run, you find you can't anymore. Pharaoh had learned never to rely on anything except herself. She slipped the bag over one shoulder, her quiver and her bow over the other. She took one last look at the sleeping shapes of the others, dark mounds clustered round the fire. Luthar had the blanket drawn up under his chin, smooth-skinned, full-lipped face turned towards the glowing embers. Baez had his back to her, but she could see the dim light shining off his bald pate, the back of one dark ear, hear the slow rhythm of his breathing. Longfoot had his blanket pulled up over his head, but his bare feet stuck from the other end, thin and bony, tendons standing out like tree roots from the mud. Kwai's eyes were open, the tiniest chink, firelight shining wet on a slit of eyeball, made it look like he was watching her. But his chest was moving slowly up and down, mouth hanging slack, sound asleep and dreaming, no doubt. Pharaoh frowned. Just four. Where was the big pink? She saw his blanket lying empty on the far side of the fire, dark folds and light folds, but no man inside. Then she heard his voice. Going already? Behind her. That was a surprise, that he could have crept around her like that while she was stealing food. He seemed too big, too slow, too noisy to creep up on anyone. She cursed under her breath. She should have known better than to go by the way things seemed. She turned slowly round to face him and took one step towards the horses. He followed, keeping the distance between them the same. Pharaoh could see the glowing fire reflected in one corner of each of his eyes, a curve of cratered, stubbly cheek, the vague outline of his bent nose, a few strands of greasy hair floating over his head in the breeze, slightly blacker than the black land behind.
I don't want to fight you, Pink. I've seen you fight.
She had seen him kill 5 men in a few moments, and even she had been surprised. The memory of the laughter echoing from the walls, his twisted, hungry face, half-snarl, half-smile, covered in blood and spit and madness, the ruined corpses strewn on the stones like rags, all this was sharp in her mind. Not that she was frightened, of course, for Pharaoh Mal'jin felt no fear. But she knew when to be careful.
"I've no wish to fight you either," he said.
But if Baez finds you gone in the morning, he'll have me chasing you. I've seen you run, and I'd rather fight you than chase you. At least I'd have some chance. He was stronger than her, and she knew it. Almost healed now, moving freely. She regretted helping him with that. Helping people was always a mistake. A fight was an awful risk. She might be tougher than others, but she'd no wish to have her face broken into slop like that big man, the stone splitter. No wish to be stuck through with a sword, to have her knees smashed, her head ripped half off. None of that held any appeal. But he was too close to shoot, and if she ran, he'd rouse the others, and they had horses. Fighting would probably wake them anyway, but if she could land a good blow quickly, she might get away in the confusion. Hardly perfect, but what choice did she have? She slowly swung the bag off her shoulder and lowered it to the ground, then her bow and her quiver. She put one hand onto the hilt of her sword, fingers brushing the grip in the darkness, and he did the same.
All right then, Pink. Let's get to it.
Might be there's another way. She watched him, suspicious, ready for tricks.
What way?
Stay with us. Give it a few days. If you don't change your mind, well, I'll help you pack. You can trust me. Trust was a word for fools. It was a word people used when they meant to betray you. If he moved forward a finger's width, she would sweep the sword out and take his head off. She was ready. But he did not move forward, and he did not move back. He stood there, a big, silent outline in the darkness. She frowned, fingertips still tickling the grip of the curved sword.
Why should I trust you?
The big pink shrugged his heavy shoulders.
Why not? Back in the city, I helped you, and you helped me. Without each other, might be we'd both be dead.
It was true, she supposed. He had helped her. Not as much as she had helped him, but still.
Time comes, you gotta stick at something, don't you? That's the thing about trust. Sooner or later, you just gotta do it, without good reasons.
Why?
Otherwise you end up like us, and who wants that?
I'll do you a deal. You watch my back, I'll watch yours.
He tapped his chest slowly with his thumb.
I'll stick.
He pointed at her.
You'll stick.
What do you say?
Pharaoh thought about it. Running had given her freedom, but little else. It had taken her through years of misery to the very edge of the desert, hemmed in by enemies. She had run from Yulwe, and the Eaters had nearly taken her. Where would she run to now, anyway? Would she run across the sea to Kanta? Perhaps the Big Pink was right. Perhaps the time had come to stop running. At least until she could get away unnoticed.
She took her hand away from her sword, slowly folded her arms across her chest, and he did the same. They stood there for a long moment, watching one another in the darkness, in the silence.
All right, Pink, she growled. I will stick, as you say, and we will see. But I make no fucking promises, you understand?
I didn't ask for promises.
My turn at the watch. You get some rest.
I need no rest, I told you that.
Suit yourself, but I'm sitting down.
Fine.
The big pink began to lower himself cautiously towards the earth, and she followed him. They sat cross-legged where they had stood, facing each other, the embers of the campfire glowing beside them, casting a faint brightness over the four sleepers, across one side of the pink's lumpy face, casting a faint warmth across hers. They watched each other.
Chapter 7 Allies.
To Archlector Salt, head of His Majesty's Inquisition. Your Eminence, work is underway on the defences of the city. The famous land walls, though powerful, are in a shameful condition, and I have taken vigorous steps to strengthen them. I have also ordered extra supplies, food, armour, and weapons, essential if the city is to stand a siege of any duration. Unfortunately, the defences are extensive, and the scale of the task vast. I have begun the work on credit, but credit will only stretch so far. I most humbly entreat that Your Eminence will send me funds with which to work. Without money, our efforts must cease, and the city will be lost. The Union forces here are few, and morale is not high. There are mercenaries within the city, and I have ordered that more be recruited, but their loyalty is questionable, particularly if they cannot be paid. I therefore request that more of the king's soldiers might be sent. Even a single company could make a difference. You will hear from me soon. Until then, I serve and obey. Sandan Glockta, Superior of Dagoska.
"This is the place," said Glockter.
"Huh?"
said Frost. It was a rough building of one story, carelessly built from mud bricks, no bigger than a good-sized woodshed. Chinks of light spilled out into the night from around the ill-fitting door and the ill-fitting shutters in the single window. It was much the same as the other huts in the street, if you could call it a street. It hardly looked like the residence of a member of Dagoska's ruling council. But then Kadia is the odd man out in many ways, the leader of the natives, the priest without a temple, the one with least to lose, perhaps. The door opened before Glockter even had the chance to knock. Kadia stood in the doorway, tall and slender in his white robe.
"Why don't you come in?"
The Haddish turned, stepped over to the only chair, and sat down in it.
"Wait here," said Glockter.
"Hmm?"
The inside of the shed was no more auspicious than the outside. Clean and orderly and poor as hell. The ceiling was so low that Glockter could only just stand upright. The floor was hard-packed dirt. A straw mattress lay on empty crates at one end of the single room, a small chair beside it. A squat cupboard stood under the window, a few books stacked on top, a guttering candle burning beside them. Apart from a dented bucket for natural functions, that appeared to be the full extent of Kadia's worldly possessions. No sign of any hidden corpses of superiors of the Inquisition, but you never know. A body can be packed away quite neatly if one cuts it into small enough pieces. "You should move out of the slums." Glockter shut the door behind him on creaking hinges, limped to the bed, and sat down heavily on the mattress.
"Natives are not permitted within the upper city, or had you not heard?
I'm sure that an exception could be made in your case. You could have chambers in the citadel. Then I wouldn't have to limp all the way down here to speak to you."
"Chambers in the citadel? While my fellows rot down here in the filth? The least a leader can do is to share the burdens of his people. I have little other comfort to give them."
It was sweltering hot down here in the lower city, but Kadia did not seem uncomfortable. His gaze was level, his eyes were fixed on Glockter's, dark and cool as deep water.
"Do you disapprove?"
Glockter rubbed at his aching neck.
"Not in the least. Martyrdom suits you, but you'll have to forgive me if I don't join in."
He licked at his empty gums.
"I've made my sacrifices."
"Perhaps not all of them. Ask your questions."
"Straight to business, then. Nothing to hide, or nothing to lose.
Do you know what became of my predecessor, Superior de Voost?"
"It is my earnest hope that he died in great pain."
Glockter felt his eyebrows lift. The very last thing I expected, an honest answer. Perhaps the first honest answer that I have received to that question, but hardly one that frees him from suspicion.
"In great pain, you say?"
"Very great pain, and I will shed no tears if you join him."
Glockter smiled.
"I don't know that I can think of anyone who will, but de Voost is the matter in hand. Were your people involved in his disappearance?"
"It is possible. De Voost gave us reasons enough. There are many families missing husbands, fathers, daughters because of his purges, his tests of loyalty, his making of examples. My people number many thousands, and I cannot watch them all. The one thing I can tell you is that I know nothing of his disappearance. When one devil falls, they always send another. And here you are. My people have gained nothing."
"Except de Voost's silence. Perhaps he discovered that you had made a deal with the Gurkish. Perhaps joining the Union was not all your people hoped for."
Kadia snorted.
"You know nothing. No Dagoskan would ever strike a deal with the Gurkish."
"To an outsider, the two of you seem to have much in common."
"To an ignorant outsider, we do. We both have dark skin, and we both pray to God, but that is the full extent of the similarity. We Dagoskans have never been a warlike people. We remained here on our peninsula, confident in the strength of our defenses, while the Gurkish Empire spread like a cancer across the Cantic continent. We thought their conquests were none of our concern. That was our folly. Emissaries came to our gates, demanding that we kneel before the Gurkish Emperor and acknowledge that the prophet Kalul speaks with the voice of God. We would do neither, and Kalul swore to destroy us. Now it seems he will finally succeed. All of the south will be his dominion.
And the Archlector will not be in the least amused. Who knows? Perhaps God will come to your aid.
God favors those who solve their own problems.
Perhaps we can solve some problems between us.
I have no interest in helping you.
Even if you help yourself as well? I have it in mind to issue a decree. The gates of the upper city will be opened. Your people will be allowed to come and go in their own city as they please. The spices will be turned out of the great temple, and it shall once again be your sacred ground. The Dagoskans will be permitted to carry arms. Indeed, we will provide you with weapons from our own armories. The natives will be treated like full citizens of the Union. They deserve nothing less.
So.
Kadia clasped his hands together and sat back in his creaking chair.
Now, with the Gurkish knocking at the gates, you come to Dagoska, flaunting your little scroll as though it was the word of God, and you choose to do the right thing. You are not like all the others. You are a good man, a fair man, a just man. You expect me to believe this?
Honestly, I don't care a shit what you believe, and I care about doing the right thing even less. That's all a matter of who you ask. As for being a good man, and Glockter curled his lip, that ship sailed long ago, and I wasn't even there to wave it off. I'm interested in holding Dagoska, that and nothing else.
And you know you cannot hold Dagoska without our help.
Neither one of us is a fool, Kadia. Don't insult me by acting like one. We can bicker with each other until the Gurkish tide sweeps over the land walls, or we can cooperate. You never know. Together, we might even beat them. Your people will help us dig the ditch, repair the walls, hang the gates. You will provide 1,000 men to serve in the defense of the city to begin with, and more later.
Will I? Will I indeed? And if, with our help, the city stands, will our deal stand with it?
If the city stands, I will be gone. More than likely, Verms and the rest will be back in charge, and our deal will be dust. If the city stands, you have my word that I will do everything possible.
Everything possible, meaning nothing.
You get the idea. I need your help, so I'm offering you what I can. I'd offer you more, but I don't have more. You could sulk down here in the slums with the flies for company and wait for the Emperor to come. Perhaps the great Usman Uldosht will offer you a better deal. Glockter looked Kadia in the eye for a moment. But we both know he won't. The priest pursed his lips, stroked his beard, then gave a deep sigh.
They say a man lost in the desert must take such water as he is offered, no matter who it comes from. I accept your deal. Once the temple is empty, we will dig your holes and carry your stone and wear your swords. Something is better than nothing, and, as you say, perhaps together we can even beat the Gurkish. Miracles do happen.
So I've heard, said Glockter as he shoved on his cane and grunted his way to his feet, shirt sticking to his sweaty back. So I've heard, but I've never seen one. Glockter stretched out on the cushions in his chambers, head back, mouth open, resting his aching body. The same chambers that were once occupied by my illustrious predecessor, Superior de Voost. They were a wide, airy, well-furnished set of rooms. Perhaps they once belonged to a Dagoskan prince, or a scheming vizier,
or a dusky concubine, before the natives were thrown out into the dust of the lower city. Better by far than my pokey shithole in the Agriant, except that superiors of the Inquisition have been known to go missing from these rooms. One set of windows faced northward, out towards the sea, on the steepest side of the rock. The other looked over the baking city. Both were equipped with heavy shutters. Outside, it was a sheer drop over bare stone to jagged rocks and angry salt water. The door was 6 fingers thick, studded with iron, fitted with a heavy lock and 4 great bolts. Davoust was a cautious man, and with good reason, it would seem. So how could assassins have got in? And having got in, how could they remove the body? He felt his mouth curving into a smile. How will they remove mine when they come? Already my enemies mount up, the sneering worms, the punctilious Visbrook, the merchants whose profits I threaten, the practicals who served Harker and Davoust, the natives with good reason to hate anyone who wears black, my old enemies the Gurkish, of course, and all that, providing His Eminence does not get anxious at the lack of progress and decide to have me replaced himself. Will anyone come searching for my twisted corpse, I wonder?
Superior.
Opening his eyes and lifting his head was a great and painful effort. Everything hurt from his exertions of the past few days. His neck clicked like a snapping twig with every movement. His back was stiff and brittle as a mirror. His leg veered between nagging agony and trembling numbness. Shickle was standing in the doorway, head bowed. The cuts and bruises on her dark face were healed. There was no outward sign of the ordeal she had suffered in the cells below. She never looked him in the eye, though, always at the floor. Some wounds take time to heal, and others never do. I should know.
What is it, Shickle?
Magister Ida sends you an invitation to dinner.
Doth she indeed? The girl nodded.
Send word that I will be honored to attend.
Glockter watched her pad out of the room, head bowed, then he sagged back onto his cushions. If I disappear tomorrow, at least I will have saved one person. Perhaps that means my life has not been a total waste of time. Sand Dan Glockter, shield to the helpless. Is it ever too late to be a good man?
Please!
Squealed Harker.
Please! I know nothing!
He was bound tightly to his chair, unable to move his body far. But he makes up for it with his eyes. They darted back and forth over Glockter's instruments, glittering in the harsh lamplight on the scarred tabletop. Oh, yes, you understand better than most how this will work. Knowledge is so often the antidote to fear. But not here, not now.
I know nothing!
I will be the judge of what you know. Glockter wiped some sweat from his face. The room was hot as a busy forge, and the glowing coals in the brazier were far from helping. If a thing smells like a liar and is the colour of a liar, the chances are it is a liar. Would you not agree?
Please! We're all on the same side!
Are we? Are we really?
I have told you only the truth!
Perhaps, but not as much of it as I need.
Please! We're all friends here!
Friends? In my experience, a friend is merely an acquaintance who hath yet to betray you. Is that what you are, Harker?
No!
Glockter frowned. Then you are our enemy.
What? No, I wanted to know what happened, that's all. I didn't mean to. Please!
Please, 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 I tire of hearing it.
You have to believe me!
The only thing I have to do is get answers.
Only ask your questions, Superior, I beg of you. Only give me the opportunity to cooperate.
Oh, indeed. The firm hand does not seem such a fine idea any longer, does it?
Ask your questions. I will do my best to answer.
Good. Glockter perched himself on the edge of the table, just beside his tightly bound prisoner, and looked down at him. Excellent. Harker's hands were tanned deep brown, his face was tanned deep brown, the rest of his body was pale as a white slug, with thick patches of dark hair. Hardly a fetching look, but it could be worse. Answer me this, then. Why is it that men have nipples? Harker blinked. He swallowed. He looked up at Frost, but there was no help there. The albino stared back, unblinking, white skin round his mask beaded with sweat, eyes hard as two pink jewels.
I'm not sure I understand, Superior.
Is it not a simple question? Nipples, Harker, on men. What purpose do they serve? Have you not often wondered?
I...
Glockter sighed. They chafe and become painful in the wet. They dry out and become painful in the heat. Some women, for reasons I could never fathom, insist on fiddling with them in bed, as though we derive anything but annoyance from having them interfered with.
Glockter reached towards the table, while Harker's wide eyes followed his every movement and slid his hand slowly around the grips of the pincers. He lifted them up and examined them, the well-sharpened jaws glinting in the bright lamplight.
A man's nipples, he murmured, are a positive hindrance to him. Do you know, aside from the unsightly scarring, I don't miss mine in the least.
He grabbed the tip of Harker's nipple and dragged it roughly towards him.
Ah!
Squawked the one-time inquisitor, the chair creaking as he tried desperately to twist away.
No!
You think that hurts? Then I doubt you'll enjoy what's coming.
And Glockter slid the open jaws of the pincers around the stretched-out flesh and squeezed them tight.
Please, Superior, I beg you!
Your begging is worthless to me. What I need from you is answers. What became of Davoust?
I swear on my life that I don't know!
Not good enough.
Glockter began to squeeze harder, the metal edges starting to bite into the skin. Harker gave a despairing shriek.
Wait! I took money! I admit it, I took money!
Money?
Glockter let the pressure release a fraction, and a drop of blood dripped from the pincers and spattered on Harker's hairy white leg.
What money?
Money Davoust took from the natives after the rebellion. He had me round up any that I thought might be rich, and he had them hanged along with the rest, and we requisitioned everything they had and split it between us. He kept his share in a chest in his quarters, and when he disappeared, I took it.
Where is this money now?
Gone. I spent it on women and on wine and on anything.
Glockter clicked his tongue.
Tut, tut.
Greed and conspiracy, injustice and betrayal, robbery and murder. All the ingredients of a tale to titillate the masses. Saucy, but hardly relevant. He worked his hand around the pincers.
It is the Superior himself, not his money, that interests me. Believe me when I say that I grow tired of asking the question, what became of Davoust?
I don't know.
True, perhaps, but hardly the answer I need. Not good enough.
Glockter squeezed his hand, and the metal jaws bit cleanly through flesh and met in the middle with a gentle click. Harker bellowed and thrashed and roared in agony, blood bubbling from the red square of flesh where his nipple used to be and running down his pale belly in dark streaks. Glockter winced at a twinge in his neck and stretched his head out until he heard it click.
Strange how, with time, even the most terrible suffering of others can become tedious.
Practical Frost, the Inquisitor is bleeding, if you please.
Sorry.
The iron scraped as Frost dragged it from the brazier, glowing orange. Glockta could feel the heat of it even from where he was sitting.
Ah, hot iron. It keeps no secrets. It tells no lies.
No! No!
Harker's words dissolved into a bubbling scream as Frost ground the brand into the wound and the room filled slowly with the salty aroma of cooking meat. A smell which, to Glockta's disgust, caused his empty stomach to rumble.
How long is it since I had a good slice of meat?
He wiped a fresh sheen of sweat from his face with his free hand and worked his aching shoulders under his coat.
An ugly business that we find ourselves in, so why do I do this?
The only answer was the soft crunch as Frost slid the iron carefully back into the coals, sending up a dusting of orange sparks. Harker twisted and whimpered and shook, his weeping eyes bulging, a strand of smoke still curling up from the blackened flesh on his chest.
An ugly business, of course. No doubt he deserves it, but that changes nothing. Probably he has no clue what became of DeVoost, but that changes nothing either. The questions must be asked, and exactly as if he did know the answers.
Why do you insist on defying me, Harker? Could it be that you suppose that once I'm done with your nipples, I'll have run out of ideas? Is that what you're thinking? That your nipples are where I'll stop? Harker stared at him, bubbles of spit forming and breaking on his lips. Glockta leaned closer.
Oh, no, no, no. This is only the beginning. This is before the beginning. Time opens up ahead of us in pitiless abundance. Days and weeks and months of it, if need be. Do you seriously believe that you can keep your secrets for that long? You belong to me now, to me and to this room. This cannot stop until I know what I need to know.
He reached forward and gripped Harker's other nipple between thumb and forefinger. He took up the pincers and opened their bloody jaws.
How difficult can that be to understand?
Magister Ida's dining chamber was fabulous to behold. Cloths of silver and crimson, gold and purple, green and blue and vivid yellow rippled in the gentle breeze from the narrow windows. Screens of filigree marble adorned the walls. Great pots as high as a man stood in the corners. Heaps of pristine cushions were tossed about the floor, as though inviting passers-by to sprawl in comfortable decadence. Coloured candles burned in tall glass jars, casting warm light into every corner, filling the air with sweet scent. At one end of the marble hall, clear water trickled gently in a star-shaped pool. There was more than a touch of the theatrical about the place.
Like a queen's boudoir from some cantic legend.
Magister Ida, head of the Guild of Spices, was herself the centerpiece.
The very queen of merchants.
She sat at the top of the table in a pristine white gown, shimmering silk with just the slightest, fascinating hint of transparency. A small fortune in jewels flashed on every inch of tanned skin. Her hair was piled up and held in place with ivory combs, excepting a few strands curling artfully around her face. It looked very much as if she had been preparing herself all day.
And not a moment was wasted.
Glockta, hunched in his chair at the opposite end with a bowl of steaming soup before him, felt as if he had shuffled into the pages of a storybook.
A lurid romance set in the exotic south, with Magister Ida as the heroine and myself the disgusting, the crippled, the black-hearted villain. How will this fable end, I wonder?
So, tell me, Magister, to what do I owe this honour? I understand that you have spoken to the other members of the council. I was surprised, and just a little hurt, that you had not sought an audience with me already.
I apologize if you felt left out. It seemed only fitting that I saved the most powerful until last.
She looked up with an air of injured innocence, and a most consummately acted one.
Powerful? Me? Verns controls the budget, issues the decrees, Visbrook commands the troops, holds the defenses. Cadia speaks for the great majority of the populace. I scarcely figure.
Come now, Glockta grinned his toothless grin. You are radiant, of course, but I am not quite blinded. Verm's budget is a pittance compared to what the spices make. Cadia's people have been rendered almost helpless. Through your pickled friend Koska, you command more than twice the troops that Visbrook does. The only reason the Union is even interested in this thirsty rock is for the trade that your guild controls.
Well, I don't like to boast.
The Magister gave an artless shrug. But I suppose that I do have some passing influence in the city. You have been asking questions, I see.
That's what I do.
Glockta raised his spoon to his mouth, trying his best not to slurp between his remaining teeth.
This soup is delicious, by the way. And one hopes not fatal.
I thought you might appreciate it. You see, I have been asking questions also. The water plopped and tinkled in the pool, the fabric rustled on the walls, the silverware clicked gently against the fine pottery of their bowls. I would call that first round a draw. Carlotte Dan Ida was the first to break the silence.
I realize, of course, that you have a mission from the Archlector himself, a mission of the greatest importance. I see that you are not a man to mince your words, but you might want to tread a little more carefully.
I admit my gait is awkward. A war wound, compounded by 2 years of torture. It's the wonder I got to keep the leg at all.
She smiled wide, displaying 2 rows of perfect teeth.
I am thoroughly tickled, but my colleagues have found you somewhat less entertaining. Verms and Visbrook have both taken a decided dislike to you. High-handed was the phrase they used, I believe, among others. I had better not repeat.
Glockta shrugged.
I am not here to make friends.
And he drained his glass of a predictably excellent wine.
But friends can be useful. If nothing else, a friend is one less enemy. De Voost insisted on upsetting everyone, and the results have not been happy.
De Voost did not enjoy the support of the Clothed Council.
True, but no document will stop a knife thrust.
Is that a threat?
Carlotte Dan Ida laughed. It was an easy, open, friendly laugh. It was hard to believe that anyone who made such a sound could be a traitor, or a threat, or anything other than a perfectly charming host.
And yet I am not entirely convinced.
That is advice. Advice born of bitter experience. I would prefer it if you did not disappear quite yet.
Really? I had no idea I was such a winning dinner guest.
You are terse, confrontational, slightly frightening, and impose severe restrictions on the menu. But the fact is, you are more used to me here than...
And she waved her hand. Wherever De Voost went to.
Would you care for more wine?
Of course.
She got up from her chair and swept towards him, feet padding on the cool marble like a dancer's.
Bare feet in the cantic fashion.
The breeze stirred the flowing garments around her body as she leaned forwards to fill Glockta's glass, wafted her rich scent in his face.
Just the sort of woman my mother would have wanted me to marry. Beautiful, clever, and oh, so very rich. Just the sort of woman I would have wanted to marry, for that matter, when I was younger, when I was a different man.
The flickering candlelight shone on her hair, flashed on the jewels around her long neck, glowed through the wine as it sloshed from the neck of the bottle.
Does she try and charm me merely because I hold the writ of the Closed Council?
nothing more than good business to be on good terms with the powerful? Or does she hope to fool me and distract me and lure me away from the unpleasant truth? Her eyes met his briefly, and she gave a tiny, knowing smile and looked back to his glass. Am I to be her little urchin boy, dirty face pressed up against the baker's window, mouth watering for the sweetmeats I know I can never afford? I think not. Where did Davoust go to? Magister Ida paused for a moment, then carefully set down the bottle. She slid into the nearest chair, put her elbows on the table, her chin on her hands, and held Glockter's eye. I suspect that he was killed by a traitor in the city, probably an agent of the Gurkish. At the risk of telling you what you already know, Davoust suspected there was a conspiracy afoot within the city's ruling council. He confided as much to me shortly before his disappearance. Did he indeed? A conspiracy within the ruling council? Glockter shook his head in mock horror. Is such a thing possible? Let us be honest with each other, Superior. I want what you want. We in the Guild of Spicers have invested far too much time and money in this city to see it fall to the Gurkish, and you seem to offer a better chance of holding on to it than those idiots Worms and Visbrook. If there is a traitor within our walls, I want him found. Him or her? Magister Ida raised one delicate eyebrow. It cannot have escaped your notice that I am the only woman on the council. It hath not. Glockter slurped noisily from his spoon. But forgive me if I don't discount you quite yet. It will require more than good soup and pleasant conversation to convince me of anyone's innocence, although it's a damn sight more than anyone else has offered me. Magister Ida smiled as she raised her glass. Then how can I convince you? Honestly, I need money. Ah, money. It always comes back to that. Getting money out of my guild is like trying to dig up water in the desert. Tiring, dirty, and almost always a waste of time. Somewhat like asking questions of Inquisitor Harker. How much were you thinking of? We could begin with, say, 100,000 marks. Ida did not actually choke on her wine, more of a gentle gurgle. She set her glass down carefully, quietly cleared her throat, dabbed at her mouth with the corner of a cloth, then looked up at him, eyebrows raised. You very well know that no such amount will be forthcoming. I'll settle for whatever you can give me for now. We'll see. Are your ambitions limited to a mere 100,000 marks, or is there anything else I can do for you? Actually, there is. I need the merchants out of the temple. Ida rubbed gently at her own temples as though Glockter's demands were giving her a headache. He wants the merchants out, she murmured. It was necessary to secure Cadia's support. With him against us, we cannot hope to hold the city for long. I've been telling those arrogant fools the same thing for years, but stamping on the natives has become quite the popular pastime nonetheless. Very well. When do you want them out? Tomorrow, at the latest. And they call you high-handed. She shook her head. Very well. By tomorrow evening I could well be the most unpopular magister in living memory, if I still have my post at all. But I'll try and sell it to the guild. Glockter grinned. I feel confident that you could sell anything. You're a tough negotiator, Superior. If you ever get tired of asking questions, I have no doubt you've a bright future as a merchant. A merchant? Oh, I'm not that ruthless. Glockter placed his spoon in the empty bowl and licked at his gums. I mean no disrespect, but how does a woman come to head the most powerful guild in the Union? Ida paused, as though wondering whether to answer or not, or judging how much truth to tell when she does. She looked down at her glass, turned the stem slowly round and round. My husband was magister before me. When we married, I was 22 years old. He was near 60. My father owed him a great